session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court will hear three causes by oral submission. In the order in which they are presented, they're as follows. Brenda Ann Travis, individually and as next friend of Jason Wayne Travis and others, versus the City of Mesquite and others from Dallas County. The State Department of Highways and Public Transportation versus Dopiera from Gallatin County, and the State of Texas versus Malone Service Company and others from Galveston County. In each of these causes, we have allotted 20 minutes for the petitioner to present oral argument and 20 minutes for the respondent. The petitioner may reserve an announced amount of time for rebuttal. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and will conclude the three arguments before our noon recess. We are recording these arguments for the convenience of the court. If you desire to listen to a tape of the argument, you may make application with our clerk. Counsel in the second and third arguments do not have to remain in the courtroom during earlier matters, but we do ask that you remain nearby. Justice Heck is recused in the first cause, but will be present for the second and third causes. Court is now ready to hear argument from petitioners in Travis versus City of Mesquite.
May it please the court, Mr. Richard N. Countess will present argument from petitioner. He has reserved 4 minutes of rebuttal time.
May it please the court. As is apparent, I represent the Lozano and Travis families. Let me say that this is the first time when I was a petitioner that I didn't want to be here. As the court is well aware, it reversed and remanded this case for trial back in December and has now requested further argument on the immunity question and has granted the application on that point of error also. The reversal and remand was primarily on the basis of proximate cause. I will not address that unless the court has additional questions about it. I'm going to primarily limit my argument to the immunity question, which is what the court had asked us to do additional briefing on. But I will attempt to answer any questions you may have about other areas. The facts are, as they frame this issue, the immunity issue, relatively simple. A couple of Mesquite policemen were on private guard duty at a truck stop. They saw a suspicious vehicle. They spoke to the driver. They asked the driver to pull to the front of the parking lot where there was better lighting. And when the driver did so, he, with two passengers in his vehicle, accelerated around a stop sign, entered a freeway access road the wrong way, and the high-speed chase was on at that point. At the point of leaving the truck stop parking lot, the police officers put on their City of Mesquite patrol caps, figuratively speaking, and pursued the person going the wrong way down the interstate access road.
Counsel, did the person who fled, did he do so because the police were pursuing him or because he was in a stolen Z28 automobile?
Of course, there's no way to know that. I think to the extent that that would be an issue in the case, that's a fact question for the jury. I think we can certainly assume that he would not have fled if there had not been police wanting to talk to him about things, and I think we can assume that he probably knew they were going to run a check on that vehicle.
They had his license plate number, did they not?
I would assume they did. I don't recall specifically, but I can't believe they did not have under the circumstances.
As he was fleeing, is how fast was he going, according to the record?
In excess of the speed limit is my recollection, but I don't recall how fast.
Up to 100 miles per hour?
I think there was some evidence to that effect, yes, sir. The two patrolmen pursuing radioed, and other patrolmen pulled in behind the fleeing, or not behind the fleeing individual, pulled in on the access road at a point where they would be coming toward the individual who was going the wrong way down the access road. However, before any of them could get together, the fleeing vehicle collided with a car being driven by Brenda Travis and occupied by Mr. Lozano and Brenda Travis's three children. Mr. Lozano was killed, the Travis children and Mrs. Travis were severely injured, and this litigation ensued. The lower courts granted summary judgment in the trial court, and the Court of Appeals affirmed on the theory that there was no proximate cause as a matter of law under these facts. This court, as I have indicated earlier, concluded that there was a fact issue on proximate cause and has now asked us to discuss the immunity issue. There are two aspects of the immunity issue as it is pertinent to this case. We will look for a waiver of immunity at the Tort Claims Act, Section 101.021. And Section 101.021 gives two bases for the waiver of immunity under the facts of this case. And let me say this. There are probably 25 briefs before the court at this point in this case. Everybody has briefed it three or four times, and then all the amici in the world have filed a few briefs. Nothing has really focused on what I think are some of the key issues, including my own briefs, and I'm going to try to give a little better analysis than I have in the past. Yes, sir.
So that I can have the facts straight in my mind, does not the record reflect that at the time he made the illegal turn which put him going the wrong way, he was out of sight of the police, and that at the speed he was traveling of 100 miles per hour, the distance that he traveled before he caused this accident would have taken less than 1 minute's time?
I think there is testimony to that effect, yes, sir. Two aspects of immunity that are applicable here under 101.021. The first one, and I will take these in reverse order when I argue them, but the first one has to do with the use of a motor-driven vehicle. And the waiver simply says that a government entity is liable for injury or death that results from a motor-driven vehicle if the employee would be personally liable. I'll address that a second. The other waiver, and it's the second waiver, but I'll address it first, is that the government is liable for injury or death from the use of tangible personal property under circumstances where the government would, if a private person, be liable under Texas law. Now, the words private person, I think, are the key to that, and I want to address that first. Let me restate it. The government is liable for injury or death from use of A, tangible personal property, B, under circumstances where the government would be liable if it were a private person. Now, there's really no dispute over the first one. Obviously, the use of a vehicle is the use of tangible personal property. Also, of course, the radios were being used in connection with this. So, to the extent there is a tangible personal property element, it's clearly satisfied. The second element, would the government as a private corporation be liable under these facts for the negligent use of a vehicle? I suggest to the court that the answer to that is clear and very easily reached. If an employee of a private corporation drives a vehicle negligently in the course and scope of employment, obviously the corporation is liable for that negligence. Now, the response that the respondent gives is, but that employee may be immune, and under their theory is immune because that employee is a police officer. I say that's not how you look at it. Let's assume that the employee of a private corporation causes a car wreck. The injured party sues the corporation only, not the individual. The private corporation replies, alleging whatever defenses it may have. A private corporation does not have a judicial or governmental immunity defense. It simply does not exist for private individuals. So when the statute says that they have the same defense or they stand in the same place as a private person, it can only mean that they have the same rights and the same liabilities as a private person. And no private person has the right to claim an immunity defense, a governmental immunity defense, as of the nature that's being advanced here.
Well, Mr. Counsel, let me make sure I understand. Are you saying that the municipality's liability is not dependent on the liability of the individual police officers?
I am saying it in this sense, that whether or not that private police officer, under the second waiver, not the first one, that's a different problem. I'll talk about that in a minute. But under the second waiver, it doesn't matter whether that police officer can claim private immunity or governmental immunity or not, because you're looking at whether a corporation, and under the words of the statute, a private person, a private corporation, would be liable for the negligence of an employee in the course and scope of employment.
And you're talking strictly about the Texas Tort Claim, under the Texas Tort Claims Act. You're not talking about 1983 claims now.
Yeah, that's correct, John. That's correct. So I simply suggest to the court that under any analysis of the second provision of the waiver, or the second paragraph of the waiver, the city of Mesquite is liable, regardless of what conclusion you may reach about the liability of the individual officers. Now, let me talk for just a moment about the first waiver. It also has a two-prong test. The government is liable for the operation of a motor-driven vehicle if the employee would be personally liable. And this has been the focus of a lot of our disagreement in this case, the second element, whether or not the employee is personally liable. Again, there can be no question that a motor-driven vehicle is involved in this. And so we'll talk about the personal liability, if there is such, of the employee.
Counsel, what would you have had the police do in this case?
Well, I would have had, we're talking about hindsight, of course, and the preference would have been that they not pursue him and let the individual leave.
That they let him go?
Yes, sir.
Why?
Because they immediately could see that he had created a precarious situation, and by pursuing him, they simply heightened his desire to get away and increased the danger.
But originally, he did not go the wrong way on the freeway. Now, my question is, are you against all hot pursuits?
I am for hot pursuits within the context of carefully drafted and well-regulated pursuit policies, Your Honor. And let me add that I have a son who's a police officer, and the last thing I want to happen to him is to get killed in one of these chases. Police officers do too.
Well,
and I want him operating under a set of guidelines that protects him and protects the public and lays out sane ways of conducting these chases.
And the city of Mesquite has such a policy?
They had a policy that was pursue until caught, basically, is what it said. That's not the exact language, but it's in the record there. And it said you'll continue the pursuit until the person is apprehended, something of that nature.
From the time, though, that he made the illegal turn and went the wrong way, there was a period of less than 1 minute before he caused the accident. Could the police officers have discontinued pursuit and avoided the accident, or would the thief have kept going?
There's no way to know that, and that's something a jury should evaluate in the light of all the evidence, Your Honor. If a jury concludes that it would have made no difference, then they're going to absolve these folks in the city of any liability in this case. If they conclude, on the other hand, that from all the available circumstances brought to their attention, that pursuit continued, or that race continued because of the pursuit, then they can look at the possibility of liability. But the point where you and I think will disagree is to the extent to which there should be a shield here. And I say there should not be a shield for a policeman engaged in a chase. That's something that the jury should decide based on all of the facts.
Doesn't that really go to the officer's qualified immunity?
Yes, that's ultimately what we're talking about.
And the test, at least, is whether in a recent writ denied case, we chose not to address the Waco Court of Appeals statement that the officers have qualified immunity from personal liability while performing discretionary acts in good faith within the scope of their authority.
Yes,
of course, that's Carpenter case, and can you explain why these officers did not have qualified immunity under these circumstances?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I view the Carpenter case as being precisely in line with where I think the law should go in this situation. What the Carpenter case says,
and there was no, the Waco Court of Appeals said the constable had qualified immunity.
Yes, but you have to look at why and the analysis they used. They used the analysis you're talking about, and also respondent uses the same basic analysis in his brief in determining whether there is a qualified immunity. You look at these things. You look at whether the employee was acting within the scope and course of employment, whether the employee was acting in good faith, and whether the employee was performing discretionary functions. Now, I will concede for argument, although I don't want to concede anything ultimately, but I'll concede for argument the first two points, that they were acting within scope, and of course, we got to prove that, so that I would want that, and that I'll concede for argument that the employee was acting in good faith. The question is, was the employee performing discretionary functions? Now, Carpenter talks about a discretionary function as being something that leaves nothing to the exercise of discretion or judgment, as a non-discretionary function, as something that leaves nothing to the exercise of discretion or judgment. Discretion, then, the extent of that discretion is the key to it. And here's where the discretion terminates. The legislature of the state of Texas, in sections 24, 75, and some other sections of 6701D, said, here's how the chases are to be conducted. They are to be conducted while driving with due regard. They are to be conducted by not driving with reckless disregard. They can exceed the speed limit so long as they do not endanger life or property. Now, what I say is that those are the outer limits of the discretion that an officer has when engaged in a police chase. And when they exceed those limits, they exceed their discretion, and they lose any immunity they might have under any kind of qualified immunity.
Doesn't that mean that any time there's an accident as a result of the chase, we can, with hindsight, say the officers did not act with due regard because obviously there was an accident?
Well, it's going to be a fact-specific situation each time. and that's what this case is all about. Whether you're going to analyze these in the light of the fact specifics each one, or whether each time, or whether there's going to be an absolute shield that says nobody can get through to the officer or beyond the officer to the city when there is one of these things.
We're talking about this very limited fact situation before us. And using your third prong of your test, can you explain what the police officer did that was wrong?
Pursued a high-speed chase in a high-speed chase situation when someone is going the wrong way down an access road in this particular case.
But we've already established that there was less than 1 minute's time of pursuit before the accident. Would not the siren on the police car sound as a warning to oncoming motorists that there was a problem on that road?
Well, there is a disputed fact question on whether the siren was on, for one thing, but even assuming it was on, the question then would be whether it would reach the folks who are going to be affected by this. And again, we get back into factual disputes over who heard what, who saw what.
Well, in looking at the record, the plaintiff's own expert testified that one more siren would not have helped. So my question is, if the police officers stop so that their siren is not a warning, could they then not be sued because they did stop when they should have pursued and kept their siren and their lights going as a warning that there was something wrong to oncoming motorists?
Well,
in other words, are they damned if they do and damned if they don't?
No, sir, I don't think they are. Because we're talking about, the example I'm using is where they are engaged in the chase and the statutes say how they must conduct that chase. The statutes prescribe in very specific terms what their discretion is. I don't know of any statute that says you must chase. Now it says if you're chasing, you must use your siren. But I don't know of any statute that says you must chase, so I don't think there is cause of action there. And it may be that qualified immunity would be applicable. But I'm saying that in this circumstance, where there are prescriptions on how the chase must be conducted, when the officers exceed that, then they have violated the legislative mandate and don't have an immunity. That's basically what it comes down to.
Mr. Counsel, since some of us believe that disputed fact issues are to be resolved by juries, could you focus your attention specifically on the question of why this decision to initiate and continue the chase is not the type of discretionary decision to which qualified immunity should attach?
Well, it is part and parcel of the way that chases, of the way that law enforcement in general must behave, and specifically the way it must behave in connection with the apprehension of folks under these circumstances. We have case authority and we have statutory authority that any chase, whether it's this kind or any other kind, any police chase, must be conducted within certain parameters. And those statutes and that case law define the duty and define the standard within which the chase must be conducted. And when there are allegations and when there is evidence that those standards have been violated, then there are fact questions, and those fact questions should be resolved by a jury. That's fundamentally what our case is all about.
Do you see, how does the potential seriousness of the crime that has been observed or that the officers believe may have occurred, how does that factor in to these three elements? In other words, if it's a congested, if it's the middle of New York City, you don't chase,
right,
even if somebody's blown up the president, and if it's in a rural area, you can chase if they've somebody's exceeding the speed limit by 3 miles an hour?
I'm not aware, and that's a difficult question to answer because I don't know what the record doesn't tell us, and I don't know of my own knowledge what extent that's factored into the chase policies. I think most chase policies simply define the extent that exists at all, simply define the speeds, the circumstances, the things to be considered when engaging in a chase from the standpoint of the public danger. I don't know that they speak to the seriousness of the crime. But, you know, it seems to me that you've got the same problem no matter how serious the crime. Take the ultimate crime of capital murder. If in pursuing the person who committed that, other innocent people are killed, we've simply compounded the crime. To me, that's not as big a factor as the safety with which the pursuit is handled. I see that my time is up.
Counsel, for your information, the most extensive study done on this is by the California Highway Patrol, and they do discuss all of the factors, including the one asked.
Any other questions at this time? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, the Honorable Ronald D. Wren will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, like Judge Countess, I'm going to confine my remarks unless you've got questions to qualified immunity, and let's get started with discretionary function because I think that's where the battleground lies. Let me clarify, first of all, a couple of the facts in this case. Their attack through their expert on our chase policy is that it leaves too much discretion to the individual officer's judgment on when to discontinue the chase. That's the reason that they say it is a defective policy, because it doesn't say chase until pursued. It says chase until caught unless, in your discretion, you believe the chase should be discontinued. So their attack on the policy of the city of Mesquite is fundamentally premised on the fact that this is a discretionary function of the officer and, in their opinion, is too much delegated to his discretion. Secondly, I would point out that in Carpenter, the Waco case, they hold essentially that apprehension of suspects by a police officer out there in the field is, in essence, a discretionary function of that officer. It is not a ministerial function, and the choices as to how, when, where, whether to pursue, to arrest, not to arrest, are left to the discretion of the officer, and I think that's where qualified immunity attaches. I would further point out to the court that the issue here is not whether or not to recognize qualified immunity. It is well recognized at common law, and there are at least three specific references in the Tort Claims Act preserving qualified immunity for public officials.
Does the Tort Claims Act provision with reference to qualified immunity basically replace the common law definition or preempt the common law definition?
I don't believe so. 101.026 says, to the extent an employee has individual immunity from a tort claim for damages, it is not affected by this chapter. 102.0062, this chapter does not affect a defense, immunity, or jurisdictional bar available to a local government or an employee. 104.008, this chapter does not waive a defense, immunity, or jurisdictional bar available to the state or its officers, employees, or contractors. I believe it's just a provision to preserve the common law right of indemnity. It does not expand, it does not define, it does not restrict. It's merely a preservation mechanism.
Are we required then in any case, whether it's a police officer or some other public employee who is individually sued, to make a decision as to whether that employee's conduct was discretionary or ministerial?
I think that's correct. I think that's why the test is phrased as it is, as a discretionary function that is the key to whether there is immunity or not. It's not discretionary employees versus non-discretionary employees. It is the specific task that he is doing that allegedly gives rise to liability. That's the test as to whether qualified immunity would apply.
So whether we're talking about a daycare worker or a policeman or a hospital attendant, the analysis ought to focus on whether or not the employee is engaged in discretionary function, and if it's a discretionary function, they have immunity.
Assuming that the other elements are met, which is one of which is good faith, which will take care of a lot of this parade of horrible hypotheticals I'm getting in some of the briefs, and the other is that they are acting within the scope of their official duties. Now, if they're doing something other than official duties, if the police officers are running a drug smuggling operation on the side, clearly they're not entitled to immunity. But assuming that the other elements are met, yes, sir, if it's a discretionary function.
But if the policeman or policewoman is doing the normal duties that they face out on a patrol, on traffic duty,
yes, sir.
There really is very little aspect of that job that's not going to be discretionary, is it? Is that true?
To the extent that it's related to their law enforcement functions, I think that's correct. But there are other things, for example, the Eubanks case that he places considerable reliance on. If you want to, I disagree that that's a qualified immunity case, but assuming that it is and you want to distinguish that case, what is it that the officer was doing that gave rise to liability in that case? He was just driving along, not keeping a proper lookout. It's something any driver could have done. It had nothing specifically related to the duties of the law enforcement officer. He was not in a pursuit at the time. And he can avoid liability in that situation, not by being a better police officer,
well,
but by being a better driver. In this case, I think, however, you cannot avoid liability for my officers unless you are a different kind of police officer and engage in a different kind of law enforcement. I think that's clearly within the scope of discretionary function.
Of course, the briefs deal with the Eubanks case at some length. If the police officer in Eubanks was responding to a call and was, as he testified there, going 35 miles an hour in a 30-mile-an-hour zone, 35 to 40. Is that a discretionary function if he chooses to drive over the speed limit and route to a call?
If he's responding to a call, I think it would be a discretionary function.
And
in that case, he was not responding to the call. He was merely out on patrol driving around the street.
Well, if a police officer is responding to a call and he is operating in good faith, that is not with any desire to cause harm to others, is there any rate of speed at which he cannot operate his vehicle and still be subject to qualified immunity?
I think that's where the good faith test would come in. The federal courts under 1983 have applied what amounts to an objective, reasonable man standard. Would a reasonable man in this position believe that what he is doing is in good faith and in compliance with the law? I think you might reach a level of speed in a particular area under particular facts where he would have exceeded that good faith element. I think that's where the safety valve comes in. It's not an absolute immunity.
Well, you know the kind of examples that have been tossed around in the briefs,
yes,
about joggers, marathons, school zones, hospital zones, those kind of things. Define for the court, under the qualified immunity that you're advancing, what limitation you think exists under the good faith test that you would have a court apply to cover some of these more outrageous examples.
I think it would be, again, the federal test is a good test. Would a reasonable person in the position of an officer reasonably believe that what he was doing was in compliance with the law? If he's driving 150 miles an hour down a sidewalk for no apparent reason other than he doesn't want to get his car wet going through the puddles out on the street, that obviously he's outside of good faith in that instance. If he is, however, trying to stop somebody who is driving down the sidewalk, which is more analogous to this fact situation, then I think he might well be justified in going down that sidewalk in pursuit of that person. I think it's a very fact-specific test, and that's specifically what the Supreme Court has done with qualified immunity under 1983 in Anderson versus Creighton.
How would that differ from simply reading the TARP Claims Act on a motor-driven vehicle in conjunction with Article 6701D, Section 75, where the Texas legislature has suggested that an emergency vehicle operator, as you know, must drive with due regard for the safety of all persons on the highway?
Well, I think you also read it with Section 24 of that same statute, which says that he is personally liable to the extent that he is recklessly disregarding, which is a gross negligence standard. So if you're going to use that as the test, then gross negligence would be the test, not good faith. But I still think, in view of the other references in the Tort Claims Act, which specifically preserve common law qualified immunity as we have always known it, that good faith is the test, because that's been one of the recognized elements.
My question is, how is driving with due regard for the safety of others, that's different from the test you're advancing, isn't it?
That's different from the test because the issue they're addressing is the test. They're addressing the issue of what is the duty and what is the basis of liability. In this case, I'm addressing what are the circumstances under which a public official is immune from liability where he would otherwise be liable under state law. And I think that that 6701D is not intended to address the immunity issue.
There is really not any kind of state employee or government employee who could not come under the qualified immunity that you're talking about if they're engaged in what you describe as a discretionary function.
Yes, and that's where the court is going to have to draw the lines on a case-by-case basis, because that's where the test draws the line on whether they are engaged in discretionary functions or ministerial functions.
That carries us back to the type of case-by-case analysis that courts went through for decades in Texas over whether a function was governmental or proprietary, doesn't it?
It may be, but that is what the test says.
We would go down, and if a state janitor or city hall janitor failed to put out a sign for slick floors and to warn people of a danger created, it would be a matter of the court evaluating whether that was a discretionary function or a ministerial function.
That was what the order was, yes, sir.
But because the kind of qualified immunity that you're asking us to announce might apply as likely to a janitor at city hall as to a policeman out in hot pursuit.
It could, yes, sir, if the other elements of the test are met.
Is correct. It fair to say that under the qualified immunity standard that you urge and which you say is reflected in some cases, that if it is adopted and applied according to the test that you're talking about, it will represent a rather substantial narrowing of the scope of tort liability for governmental units in the state of Texas?
It may. I don't think so. I think if you apply it fact specifically with respect to the elements of the test, I don't believe it would.
What do you mean by that, to apply it fact specifically?
I think if you apply it on a case-by-case basis rather than what Judge Countess is contending that I'm contending for, which is an absolute across-the-board immunity rule, I think there are situations in which they are not going to be discretionary functions. The employees are not going to be performing discretionary functions.
Well,
they're going to be told what to do.
Surely. I'm sure there are some clerks that do ministerial functions all the time.
That's correct.
Pulling out the books or whatever else might be the case. But you are asking, when you say your position is started, perhaps it is, but you're asking for an absolute bar for any discretionary function of any governmental worker in the state of Texas, are you not?
No, sir. I'm asking for a bar of any liability for discretionary functions where the employee acts in good faith and acts within the scope of his governmental duties.
And if what the employee thinks he's doing or she's doing is in good faith, and if it is categorized as discretionary, it is an absolute bar.
I'm not sure it's a question of whether what the employee thinks. The cases in Texas are not real good on whether it's a subjective or an objective standard. The federal courts have applied an objective standard, and I can live with that in this case. In other words, what would a reasonable person in his position do, not what this guy thought he was doing? So I think that's where I would disagree with you on that.
Thank you.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
In the case that's before this court today, we're not talking about joggers. Are we talking about a car thief driving a stolen 280ZX?
Down the wrong way on a one-way street, 100 miles an hour, well in advance of my officers, yes, sir.
Do you know what percent of hot pursuits involve drunken drivers?
No, sir, I don't know the exact statistics.
According to California, it's 26%. Do you know what percent involve auto thieves?
No, sir, I don't know.
27%. Do you know what percent involve felons?
No, sir, I do not.
22%. So 75% of all hot pursuit involve serious criminals. Do you know how many people were killed each year by drunken drivers on the highway?
It's a substantial number, but I don't know exactly.
50,000. Do you think hot pursuit should be discontinued?
No, sir, nor do I think that this court is in a position to make that determination, I think. And that's one reason why we have a qualified immunity rule, is so that governmental employees are not holding back in the performance of their duties. The Supreme Court of the United States in Pearson versus Ray, in adopting qualified immunity in 1983 cases, said we are not going to put an officer to the choice of dereliction of duty on the one hand and being held liable for damages on the other. That's the very reason why we have qualified immunity, and that's why I'm contending for the rule that I am here.
Let me ask you the question I ask other counsel. Had the officer discontinued the pursuit and shut off his siren and his lights, could he then have been sued by the same plaintiff for failure to keep his lights and his siren going? In other words, that he failed to do an affirmative duty?
If he can be sued for keeping them on and continuing the chase, in other words, deciding to continue to chase, I see no reason either under immunity or common law as to why he could not also be liable for the decision not to chase, in other words, negligently not pursuing a person who's going down the wrong one-way street. And under the particular facts in this case, I think that would be a more egregious case than the one we're here on, because he would basically be letting a driver he knows is going the wrong way on a one-way street going 100 miles an hour with some turns where oncoming traffic is not going to see him, just let him go and wave adios, happy trails to you. I think that's a much more egregious example of liability than this case. It's a much stronger liability case from plaintiff's perspective.
Counsel, undoubtedly the research you've gathered here today will be beneficial if you retry this case, but I want to be sure that I understand you're not advocating a hot pursuit exception, are you?
I'm advocating application of the existing qualified immunity.
And you're not advocating any special rule for law enforcement in this case. You're advocating a qualified immunity rule that will apply to every governmental worker in the state who's engaged in discretionary functions in good faith.
Yes, sir, because I think that is the existing rule as preserved by the court.
Because you don't feel that under the laws of the state of Texas, we need a special exception drawn for hot pursuit or a special exception drawn for police officers. You're willing to have them abide by what you believe to be the qualified immunity defense that should be available to every governmental employee.
That's what I've asked the court for. Yes, sir.
Counsel, let me ask you about Mr. Count has said that his client's success in this case is not dependent on the qualified immunity issue as to the individual police officer. He thinks the municipality may be liable under the tangible property waiver of sovereign immunity under the Texas Tort Claims Act. Can you address that, please?
I disagree with him because I think it comes under the first prong of 101.021, which basically says that it has to arise from a use of a motor-driven vehicle, and the employee would be personally liable to the claimant according to Texas law. That prong of the act does not say if you were a private person.
So you think the liability of the municipality is dependent on the liability of the individual officers under 1983 the Tort Claims Act?
I think if their theory, as I understand it, is based upon whether to chase or not to chase, the only way it can come under the Tort Claims Act, and that's a separate issue the court may address in future case, which we unfortunately didn't raise on MSJ, is whether that is in fact arising from the use of a motor vehicle. But under that context, the only way they're going to get the liability under the Tort Claims Act is under the prong of 101.021 that deals with automobile-related cases. And in that situation, the legislature has not said you're liable if the employee as a private individual would be liable, which is what they said with respect to use of tangible property. They said if the employee is liable under Texas law, the municipality is liable. If he's not liable under Texas law, the municipality is not liable. And under 101.025, therefore, sovereign immunity is not waived in that instance.
So the liability of the municipality and the individuals turns on whether there was qualified immunity for the officers under these circumstances?
I believe so, under the Tort Claims Act version that was in effect at the time that this act ran. Now, as the court knows, the Tort Reform Act substantially modified municipal liability, and I don't think that particular keying language is in the act now. Perhaps under the current act, you could come up with a situation where the employee would be immune and the city would be liable, but I don't think under the language of the act as it existed at this point in time that that's possible. Let me make one additional point. The legislature has adopted in section 510.14.5 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code a section that makes denial of a motion for summary judgment on the basis of immunity by a public employee interlocutorily appealable. Federal courts have done the same thing by case law under 1983, and the reason is very clear. The chilling effect on the performance of official duties is not solely premised upon ultimate liability. The threat of a lawsuit, the expense of a lawsuit, having to hire an attorney, the vexation and the worry also have a chilling effect on law enforcement. And the legislature has signaled, as have the federal courts, that they want these cases resolved early. They want them resolved as a matter of law, and they want appellate review to be available immediately if that particular determination as a matter of law is not made. Let me make one final comment. Please take a look at the federal court liability part of the opinion. I remain fully convinced, and you remain fully available to tell me I'm wrong, that it is out of line totally with the current trend of liability under Section 1983. Unless the court has additional questions, I believe I'm through with my presentation.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Perhaps Mr. Wren and I are not as far apart as I thought we were. I think we are talking perhaps about the same thing and simply using different words, different procedures to get there. Because in his argument, counsel concedes that the police officers must obey the law, that there must be, quote, good faith compliance with the law. And I think that was an exact term that he used. Well, when a police officer drives a vehicle in violation of Section 24 or Section 75 of 6701D, that police officer is not in compliance with the law. Now, whether we say that is a violation of the second prong, which is good faith, or a violation of the third prong, which is discretion, and my position is that those statutes establish the limits of discretion. Whichever way you get there, we come to the same thing. We have a jury issue. Was the police officer acting properly under all the facts and circumstances? We do not have an absolute immunity. We do not have a shield of immunity.
So you think a test under the Texas Tort Claims Act should be roughly the equivalent of the test under Section 1983, whether or not the police officer reasonably believed his actions were lawful?
Well, That's what opposing counsel is saying, and I'm saying that gets to the same thing, because if you say that they must act in good faith, then part of good faith is acting within the law. No one can act outside the limits of the law and say they're acting in good faith, first because there's a presumption we all know the law, second because we're dealing specifically with police officers who certainly know the law.
Section 1983, though, Anderson versus Creighton said that it turns on a reasonable belief of lawfulness. So would that be tantamount to the good faith provision under the Texas Tort Claims Act, or do you think that's different? Not that it was unlawful, but he had a reasonable belief that his actions were lawful.
I see the parallels there, Your Honor. I really have not thought about it specifically down that line, and I don't want to agree myself right out of court on this one, but I see the parallels, and perhaps that analysis would apply. I'm not sure.
If you are to read it, though, in conjunction with the statute, as opposing counsel pointed out in response to my question, don't you have to read in the reckless disregard standard of subsection 24? And doesn't that basically get you back to a gross negligence standard that you have to meet?
That's one of only three, though. See, reckless disregard is mentioned in one part of Section 24. But another part of Section 24 talks about driving with due regard for the safety of all persons. And Section 75 says you will not endanger life or property when you're driving. Now, there is nothing in those to indicate a gross negligence standard. That's just plain old negligence. You drive with due regard. You don't endanger other folks when you're driving. That's negligence any way you look at it. I think an argument can be made, and I'm not making it today because I don't want to get into that fight. But I think an argument can be made that language may even waive the gross negligence exemplary damage provision that is not waived under the Tort Claims Act. But that's another case, and I don't want to get into that today and get sidetracked on that. One other thing I want to point out in relation to all of this. The legislature has met since you announced your decision December 31, 1990 in this case, and it did not change any statutory law. Now, I think something is to be drawn from that. And I think something also is to be drawn from the fact that when this statutory waiver was enacted, the Eubanks case was on the books. And under that, there was no immunity under the circumstances we're talking about here. So I think those are factors also to be considered. My time is up. Thank you for your attention.
Do you think that the law...
I'm sorry?
Has the change in the governmental immunity statute as part of the tort reform compromise change the applicable law that we'd be operating under?
I don't think so. I don't.
As Mr. Wren suggested?
It would not in this case because this all happened in 1983.
That's what I mean, but perhaps the current law different than what we would analyze under
There is some reckless disregard language added in another section, and if that gets into gross negligence in that area, there might be a change. But I think we've still got at least one and probably two ordinary negligence standards that are applicable to police officers when they're driving in these high-speed pursuits.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will now take a brief recess.
Item 2-5.